It is Monday, the 20th of November, 2017, and welcome to the 7th episode of the Simon Dell Show. Yes, we have made it to episode number 7, completely intact, or relatively intact. So we've got a bit of a treat today for all of you that are get excited by alcohol, and those of you especially who love your wine. We're going to be talking to a gentleman by the name of Justin Dry, who is the co-founder and the joint CEO of Vinna Mofo, a Australian startup. I think you can still call it startup. He's been going for quite a while now, but you know, I'd imagine that they still class themselves as a startup. But it's a startup with 550,000 plus members who are all regularly buying wine from Vinna Mofo. So it's been a huge, huge business success, but it came from a time, it came through some very difficult struggles and times, and Justin will talk to us about all of those. I think it now stands on that, I think they call it the hockey stick curve, that it's destined to start trading upwards and upwards very quickly. So it's very interesting to hear what Justin's got to say. We're going to talk to him about his famous About Us page. A little bit of homework for you before we start this episode and before you start listening to Justin. Go to their website, the Vinna Mofo website, and look at their About Us page. It is absolutely epic. It's a fantastic story, and it really encapsulates all of their everything that they feel about their business, their culture and their beliefs. So it's really worth having a read of that before you actually start listening to Justin. On top of all of that, I'd like to spread my thanks to Gilberto, our producer and sound engineer once again. He does a fantastic job, especially this week in the spin cycle, where for reasons that nobody can quite understand, we managed to keep dropping out mid-conversation. So we took about 4 or 5 goes at it, and Gilberto manages to stitch these things together like a bloody magician. So thank you to Gilberto. We love sound.audio if you want to check out Gilberto. Also, make sure that you follow us on our Instagram page, which is The Simon Dell Show. Very easy to find. Everything we talk about in the spin cycle segment will be posted on there, and a few other bits and pieces that we find throughout the week that we all think are amusing. Finally, please rate and review this podcast. I can't stress how important and wonderful that is if you can go and do that, especially on iTunes. If you're listening to us on SoundCloud, you can give us a little thumbs up or a heart. And but please, iTunes reviews and iTunes ratings would be good. If you have any other feedback, you can get hold of me at simon@simondell.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts. We'd love to hear ideas for guests, topics for the spin cycle, questions, whatever you think you would like to contribute. So please get in contact, and we'd love to hear from you. We will now move on to the spin cycle. As I said, it's a fantastic segment this week. Very funny, very amusing, and Patrick with his usual dad jokes. So thanks very much. Once again, we are back with the spin cycle and my co-host, the Havaianas of co-host, Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT, and the Crocs of co-host, Patrick Condren. How are you both?
Why can't I be the double pluggers?
Yeah.
I love that. That's
you could have just
awesome.
Been the bare feet, but I think Crocs are much more humiliating.
They are humiliating, absolutely.
And Pat would have the ones with
I have
fur.
No Crocs. No, I'm not going to talk. I'm not going to engage with this, Eddie. You are not allowed to propagate this misnomer that I wear Crocs.
I'm sure you've got
Patty,
the ones
Eddie,
with fur
Eddie.
On. Okay, all right.
You know,
hello.
You know,
there's only one thing I want fur on.
We might get sponsored by
that's
Crocs.
That's the dog. The dogs.
Yeah, okay.
I don't
great.
Want fur on the dogs. What did you think I meant, Eddie?
Oh, that's not even going to answer you. Thank you very much.
Anyway, Eddie, you're gonna start off this week because apparently you've got our third exaggersplaining example.
I'm so excited.
We're all excited.
We're not. Don't use the royal all.
Well, that's true. Okay, so I was having a little gin and tonic on the weekend, as I do, and I bought a beautiful tonic water by Fever Tree, which are out of the UK. And I looked on the inside and it's, you know, they're all for gin and tonic, and I'll basically won't read you the whole thing, but it says, we have sourced the earth to find the best natural ingredients for our tonic waters. Quinine from the Congo, bitter orange from Tanzania, subtle botanicals from Provence.
Anything from the first world?
Possibly. And hand-picked elderflowers from Gloucestershire. So I was very excited to share that with you tonight.
Do you think they really got all those things in there?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. I think they did.
It's a little bit like, you know, what's the point of it? Why do we care about all that stuff? Well, showing off.
You don't want hand-picked elderflower berries, whatever it was.
Hand-picked by whom?
Doesn't matter. It arouses our senses and it helps with the whole ambiance of drinking your gin and tonic and tasting those botanicals.
Pig's ass. There is absolutely no difference between the $50 bottle that you purchased and the tonic water that I buy at Black and Gold shops.
There is so much different. Oh, so much more different. No.
I can understand it when it comes to gin because of the 10 botanicals in the Bombay Sapphire. Mm-hmm. I can understand that and the difference between that and something like Hendrix, which is akin to horse piss.
Oh, stop it. It's not.
I can understand that. But when it comes to tonic water, it's just tonic water.
It seems a bit over the top for a bottle of tonic water.
If you tasted Fever Tree, honestly, you can't compare to Black and Gold.
What's the price differential? Let's cut to the chase.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, it's a couple of dollars more.
How many?
A couple.
She took out another mortgage to buy it. There.
I would be bankrupt given the amount of gin and tonic I drink.
Oh, dear.
But it's about quality, not quantity.
How much was it?
$7 for
$7 for what?
For a four-pack. That's fine.
Yeah, $1.50 for mine.
Okay, Schweppes when it's on special is, say, $2.50, but, you know.
I can't believe for $7 they went to the Congo for an ingredient. I can't. Not buying that, Eddie.
And the only way it's hand-picked, Simon, is the bloke driving the giant harvester had his hand on the steering wheel. That's the only way it's hand-picked. It's marketing. And, Eddie, I've got to say I'm just a little bit disappointed. I think you could probably tell that from the tone of my voice.
No, I couldn't at all, Pat. I'm glad you said that. Smacked me around with that.
It's a fantastic example of exaggersplaining. We'll get it up on the Instagram feed next week or as soon as we can, and hopefully someone else will make some sort of comment as to, you know, maybe other people have drunk it out there. That'll be good. That would be the challenge. If you see it in your supermarket, let's buy it, drink it, and then you can tell us exactly how wonderful it is.
So. Simon, I got some bad news for you.
Go on then.
Anyone who's posh enough to drink that stuff isn't listening to us.
Yeah, I'm afraid you might be right. Anyway, Eddie, you've got a campaign for us this week.
I have. I've been wanting to share this one with you for a little while, so I'm really excited. So, you know, I've always been on the animal trail, and I promise one show I won't talk about animals, but this show I want to share with you an amazing campaign by Rouse Honey, which is out of the UK, and what they've done is they've taken the fairy tale of Goldilocks and the Three Bears and they have changed it around. So they have Rouse Honey, all right? So who would know better than how to cook porridge is the Three Bears. But these Three Bears aren't bears. They are three gay man bears and they've got big beards. They live, yes, in a cottage. And they have done this in a beautifully creative way where they are imitating a cooking show. So not only have they taken a fairy tale, Goldilocks is nowhere to be seen, but they've got this funny and hilarious breakfast show that's made with love, fun, and cheeky humour. So I suppose what I'm saying, what I'm going to ask you, and yes, again, you haven't probably seen this one, it is directed, they say, to millennials who maybe don't eat a lot of honey, or maybe they've got honey in the cupboard but they don't have a lot of it. So what I'm asking you, yes, is it okay to use fairy tales but with a difference, to mess them up, to mess with your head?
I think I'm going to completely digress here. Years and years ago, I used to work in London and I used to sell beer for a living. This is a fair time ago. And I used to sell beer to a nightclub in London Bridge. And it was run by two gay guys who were both bears. And this was the first time I was ever exposed to that kind of
bears.
Bears. I'll explain to you. This was the first time I was
ever. We've only got 20 minutes.
I was ever exposed to that, the gay subculture of bears. And they used to run a night called Bears and Chickens.
How much can a chicken bear?
And basically it was a night where gay guys came along and you were either a bear or a chicken. The bears were obviously big, manly, hairy, beards, lots of hair everywhere, big guys. And the chickens were the young, scrawny, skinny guys. And I never realised this existed. But, you know, that bear and chicken thing is apparently a subculture of in the gay world, as it were.
So it's perfect that Rouse Honey used this concept. How clever. I didn't know that, Simon. Thank
you.
Well,
there you go. Now that's a bear is a proper thing. No, I love this. I think this is a great little campaign. I think it's really, really good, really imaginative, really creative, and I think they've done a fantastic job on it, actually.
Who are they pitching it at, though, he said, with tongue firmly in cheek?
So Rouse Honey, they designed this campaign to be targeted to millennials, basically because they thought that it's fun, humorous. These guys watch a lot of cooking shows. They probably aren't really connected to honey in an emotional way. They probably didn't grow up with honey. So how are they going to create loyalty? How are they going to create more sales? So, and how are they really going to put more honey in people's cupboards? And they're doing this through these hilariously funny man bears.
So is it targeted towards a specific audience then?
Yeah. It's a specific age group. I mean, anyone else who's going to be a secondary target audience are going to definitely like this, and they're going to think,
okay, so here's my question. Here's my question, Ed, from a journalistic perspective. You put an ad like that on the TV, it has an effect, or wherever you put it, it has a polarising effect. So there's going to be a certain group that go, I like that ad because it's got three gay bears on it. I like the concept. I think it's funny. So they're going to buy that particular honey. Is there then a trade-off with the crowd that find it offensive, and that the number of people buy it, there's a net loss, I suppose, is what I'm asking. Is there going to be a net loss because it offends more people than it attracts?
Yeah, I don't think it would offend people because it is they're giving recipes, they're giving the benefits of honey. So they're giving information as well as humour.
Have you seen some of the One Nation posts that are out there during the course of this state election?
No, but I'm not sure if they're humorous or if they...
Well, I'm just saying there's a crowd out there that would be offended.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes. Oh,
I think that crowd's so narrow now that it's...
I think you're right. They are very narrow-minded.
Well, I think it's narrow in terms of numbers as well as being narrow-minded.
Sure. Okay. I'm just curious from a devil's advocate perspective as to whether or not that is something that the advertisers would have taken into consideration.
Well, if we didn't know about man bears until Simon told us, there's a lot of people who aren't going to say that these guys aren't just normal, hairy, three bears hanging out, doing a cooking show, trying to sell some honey.
Can I ask the obvious question?
I'm not sure.
Do they shit in the woods?
I don't think that's in the advert.
I don't think it's necessarily the obvious question.
It's not a toilet paper campaign, okay?
No.
It's for honey.
Well, as we've now gone back to poo again, which is
right
where we seem to where we ended up last week.
Excellent segue.
We seem to manage to end up talking about poo 2 weeks in a row. So what we might do is we'll move on to my one for this week, because my one has absolutely no poo relation to it whatsoever. So what happened? My one this week is about packaging, and I go down to my local bottle shop perhaps once a week, which makes me sound like an alcoholic, but things. I actually enjoy going shopping in a bottle shop now. And I bought out of the fridge, the six pack fridge, a six pack of American Pale Ale called Tomahawk. And it's by a brewery called Tuatara, and I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly because it's a Kiwi brewery. And it's won lots of prizes, but I bought it purely because of the packaging, because it looks absolutely fantastic, and it's nothing like any other six-pack packaging I'd ever seen before. It's a complete box. It's beautifully decorated, beautifully illustrated. Obviously, we'll put all these pictures up on the Instagram feed so everybody can see it. But I just wondered, because this isn't the first time I've actually bought something off the shelf without even really knowing much about it, but bought it purely based on the packaging. And I just wondered if that's something that happens to other people out there as well.
I bet it is.
Certainly not when it comes to beer.
Oh, really? Really, beer and wine packaging over the last few years, or labelling, is amazing.
I do not buy beer and wine because of the packaging.
Really? Well, I must say I have. And Simon, coming from London, where when you worked there, the beer ads, and I know it's advertising, not packaging, but the beer ads were sensational in London.
I'm not saying the ads aren't sensational, but I'm saying if you're a proper beer drinker, you buy beer that you like the flavour of. You don't buy beer because of the packaging. And I think, Simon, I know you're a Pom and I've drunk the beer over there. I can understand why you would be looking for some beer with a bit of life in it via the packaging.
I think, do you know who I think it also does this well? And I think people buy very much because, and I'll stay in the same category here, but they buy very much because of the packaging, is a lot of spirit brands. There's the spirit brands, like certainly the tequilas. I bought a tequila years ago because the bottle was shaped like a cactus. There's fantastic vodka bottles.
Spiced rum.
Yeah.
Gin bottles are amazing. Went to a gin bar last night and there was about 100 different types of gin bottles. And
I think a lot of people experiment with certain products, especially in the alcohol category, because of the packaging.
I think that is the biggest load of codswallop I've ever heard in my entire life. And I mean absolutely no disrespect. You guys have got far, far, far more experience than I in the marketing world. But the people that I hang around with do not buy because of packaging. I might buy a Stilton cheese because of I like the ceramic container it comes in.
Well, there you go.
Alcohol. No. Don't try and change the topic.
Because the question was, have you ever bought anything because of the packaging?
Example, and we went down that road. I'm trying to paint you as an un-Australian Pom. So I think if you would let me continue down that path, I'd be eternally grateful.
I think we need a survey.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah, actually, good idea.
Okay. Cool.
We're going to do a survey next week, and we're going to find out if people have bought things because of that. And we're going to specifically sticking with beer here.
People bought beer because of the packaging. I think you'll find the vast number of Australians, particularly in the lower socioeconomic groups, would buy beer on price and alcohol volume.
I'm thinking on name. There's some amazing names out there for beers now with all our microbreweries.
I did say lower socioeconomic groups. So they're not in it for the taste or the packaging. They're in it to get pissed.
No, I would say that they're just having a drink after work.
Look, we'll put this out.
We'll put this
out to the general public. We'll create a survey. And then next week we'll get back and we'll work out exactly what the public think. And I will obviously be proved right and Patrick will be proved wrong.
Can I ask another question?
Yes.
Stemming from something I did this week. Pork or beef sausages?
I saw that. Yes. Pork, but it's pork every day of the week.
It went off like a frog in a sock.
And twice on Sundays.
I'm with you, brother. I was a beef man before we went to living in the UK.
Yeah.
And after 6 years of the UK, we've come back and we're pork.
See, my wife's a beef lady.
Is she an Australian?
She is, yes.
Yeah, couldn't find a decent pommy, Sheila, so you had to come and take one back.
I'm a bit of a floater on the sausages because it depends how the butcher has packaged the sausages and the variety.
That is absolute codswallop. I have never – your eyes are brown, you're that full of a Edwina. No one buys sausages on packaging.
Do you go for thick or thin,
Edwina? I go for thick.
It depends horses for courses. You've got to have thin on bread, but true. If you're having it with homemade baked beans, it's got to be thick pork sausages.
Oh.
Why the groaning? What's the
moment? Oh, no, I was doing the Homer Simpson thing.
Anyway, thank you very much for your comments and contributions this week. So we will get that poll up so people can have a vote and see what results we get. Mm. And maybe we ought to have a poll about pork and beef sausages.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's probably going to get more response than the packaging.
But we live in hope.
Or thick and thin.
Yeah, so, yeah, pork, beef, and then thick or thin. So there's a...
I don't think you want to sort of shoot all your arrows at once. You want to keep a couple in the quiver.
Be like a matrix of sausages.
I hated that movie.
What?
Yes.
Anyway, thank you both very much. We will talk to you again next week.
Nice chatting to you both. Have a great week.
Thanks very much, guys. So my interview today is with the CEO and founder, co-founder, and joint CEO, of Vino Mofo, and it is Justin Dry. So welcome to the show, Justin.
Thank you for having me. Much appreciated.
There you go. I made a mistake in that first sentence. I'm trying to sort of 9 hours on a plane does to you.
Yeah.
Now, I've got a couple of questions and a couple of statements I'm actually going to make first. Is number one, I normally ask the guests to give us an overview of their history and everything, but Vino Mofo has a epic about us page. And I'm just going to say to everyone listening to this, before pause this and go and read that page. Because how long did that take you guys to put together?
You know what? To be honest, not that long because Andre is a great writer. Andre is my co-founder and brother-in-law. Right. And he's a great writer. So he just took we just played around one day with what we thought should be on it, and then he wrote it very quickly. He's amazing at what he does in that sense.
Well, we'll come back to that, and we'll talk about that in a minute because I think there's some really interesting things in there. But the second statement or confession I wanted to make is that I don't drink wine. I know.
I'm out. See you, pal.
I was waiting for a dial tone to appear.
Yeah.
And I never have.
Oh,
and it's mainly because, and I do have a legitimate excuse, it's mainly because I've been in the beer industry for most of my life.
Okay.
So
you drink, but you just don't drink wine.
I joined what was Bass Brewers back in the UK in the late 90s, and I was a sales rep for them for years. And my probably about 8 to 10 years worth of sales and marketing, my early stage was all with beer companies. And that was Bass Brewers and Coors and Heineken and Interbrew and all those, and Forex as well, actually, Forex and Tui's. So
I'm still hearing a great excuse.
My confession is I have drunk wine, obviously, but I've never appreciated it in the manner that I suspect you appreciate it.
So, but you have drunk it before?
A glass here or there.
Okay, cool. Well, okay. All right. I'll remain on the interview.
And I know you guys have got something, it's about 500,000 subscribers now?
Yeah, I think it's about 550 or something, I guess, yeah.
Do they surprise you with the passion that they have for the product?
Nothing really surprises me about passion for wine because... I've been a wine nerd and super passionate about it, you know, since I was a teenager. And so I don't think you're going to find more passionate people than the 120 odd people that we have working for us. So I'm surrounded by it. So no, I'm not actually that surprised. Occasionally I find one random person that is just completely over the top and I can be surprised, but it is so rare these days because I'm surrounded by such passion anyway.
How were you introduced to wine?
My family obviously drank wine as I was growing up as a kid, but probably the biggest influence early was my uncle, Uncle Peter. And he's a viticulturist, and he, which is basically the grape growing side of the wine business. And he was a lecturer,
okay,
at uni. He used to teach viticulture, and he used to write. Like, he's quite well known in that world, and he, you know, travels all over the world consulting. But he used to write the textbooks that people would study at university. And Australia's got a really famous university for winemaking and grape growing, which is in Adelaide.
Okay.
Used to be based out of Roseworthy. It's now Adelaide Main's campus, or the Wake campus, I think. So he was this kind of really well-known guy in that space, and he used to write textbooks. And he, at family Christmases, so he was, you know, he loved his wine, but at family kind of Christmases or gatherings, he would kind of pull me aside. You know, I was a teenager at this stage. I wasn't probably even supposed to be drinking. and he would pull me aside, and he'd line up some wine glasses, and he'd make me do a blind tasting. And so he would, like, you know, three or four glasses, and he'd ask me the variety and the vintage and the region. And I'd be like, Uncle Peter, like, how the hell am I supposed to pick this? I don't even drink wine. And he'd talk me through what they should look like. So what that region would look like, what that vintage would look like, and what that variety, you know, would look like, smell like, taste like. And he'd kind of guide me through it. So he was probably the first guy that got me interested.
And what was it? What was it about that? Because, I mean, you know, uncles can do that, and you know, parents can influence you, but there obviously needs to be, there's something that there must have been a hook for you at that
point.
Yeah,
I think it's, I actually think it's in our DNA. Like, I think my ancestors actually planted some of the first vines in the Barossa, which I found out later.
Wow.
So some of the oldest Shiraz vines in the entire world were planted by my ancestors in the Barossa Valley in South Australia. And so Uncle Peter used to tell me these stories about that, and then he'd talk me through these wines. And I think it's obviously in the DNA, and I just fell in love with the, you know, like the different kind of things you could get from wine. And I really love the experience of tasting and smelling and all these fascinating flavors and aromas and what they meant and what you could tell because of them. And so I just got lost in it, you know.
Wow.
And I think I just fell in love with it. And so after that, and learning about our family history. And then I actually went and studied at uni. And so I studied wine marketing originally. It was a marketing degree with a focus on wine. And I did that for a while. And then I went back and did some chemistry so I could study wine making. And then I didn't actually finish the wine making degree, but I finished the marketing degree and started working in the wine industry for a few years. I was holding tastings for people. So I was, I'd go to different locations around the city that I lived in, holding tastings for different wineries. Then I worked in a wine shop. So I just was surrounded by it really early, and I just fell in love with it. And, you know, you can tell how much I fell in love with it. By the time I was 18, I think for my 18th birthday, my parents offered, you know, to kind of hold a party at their place and, you know, buy some beer and some wine and have my friends around. And, you know, what they said, you know, what is that? Does that sound good to you? And I was like, you know what? What I prefer? And they're like, yeah, what? I was like, I prefer to spend all the money that you're going to spend on like a really nice bottle of wine that I could never afford myself and just have it with a dinner with my family and you cook my favorite dish.
Yeah.
And my mom's like, really? I was like, yeah. And that, thinking, wow. Well, that works for them too, because they get to try the wine. so they gave me enough money, and I went down and bought my birth year of a bottle of Penfolds Grange. That's a 77, and I was 18. And I think I went down like, you know, that following Saturday or something, and went down to the store, bought it, and, you know, I was handing over so much money. When I said to the guy, the wine store, I was like, I'll have that one. And he was like, really? Looking at me going, what is this 18-year-old doing ordering the most expensive bottle of wine we have in the store?
How much was it?
Oh, I think it was back then it was probably a couple hundred bucks,
which is still a lot of money.
Yeah. And yeah, it's a lot now, but that same bottle now would probably be, you know, 700 to 1,000, I reckon. In, you know, equivalent kind of time, you know, it's a 77 Grange. So it wasn't one of the greatest years of Grange, but, you know, still worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I ordered this, I bought this wine and I remember taking it out to the car and I was holding it like it was the most precious thing in the entire world because I'd never held anything so expensive in my life that was fragile, you know, and it was almost like I was holding a baby. And I remember trying to open the door but not wanting to take both hands off the bottle. And I took it home and I opened it and I decanted it over a couple of hours before dinner. And every time I walked past the kitchen and I'd see it, you know, I'd have this kind of thing, I'd smile to myself and I'd go and smell it a little bit. And I just watched it evolve over time. And, you know, wine changes so much when it has some air. And this was just a magical experience. And I think I was just hooked super early. I had no chance, really.
I think that's incredibly lucky. I think that's incredibly lucky to find a passion like that early on in life because lots of people don't get that, you know. Yeah, they're still looking for it, you know, in their 30s and 40s and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I kind of went away from it for a while as well. So I had that super passion. And then about 23, I went off and started other businesses. And I only got back to wine when I was about 28 or 29, I reckon. So
was that,
I
had would that five been years off. 2007? Would it
yeah,
be?
2006, 2007, when we launched our first kind of wine online business, which was called Quaff.
Yeah. So what other businesses did you go in? Because I'm interested in that and that why you then sort of decided to go away and from what was clearly a passion for you.
Yeah, well, I think I'd been starting. I had two passions in life and like many actually, you know, sport I loved as well. But the two kind of main ones that stand out to me is I always loved creating businesses, like even from when I was a kid. So I had like a business when I was like 10. And it was like a lawn mowing and car washing business in the neighborhood. And I used to go door knocking and I created quite a decent business. And I had enough clients that I hired my first person when I was like 10 and a half, I think.
Were they older than you or were they 10 as well?
No, they were 10 as well. It was my cousin.
Okay, right.
He was the easiest guy. He was just standing there. So my hiring policy was you're standing there, you've got the job.
Yeah.
And I hired him and it's so funny because I actually ended up firing him about pretty quickly after because he'll be forever known as Lazy Ben.
Are you still friends with him today?
Oh, I love him. I went to his wedding actually last weekend. I wanted to make a speech so I could tell that story. but yeah, so Lazy Ben is a lovely man, but he was more interested in going to the shops and buying lollies and actually doing the hard work. And
I can just imagine the conversation between two 10-year-olds with one of them firing the other one.
It was probably pretty uncomfortable. But it was my first experience at hiring and firing. So that was but that kind of was my first business. And then I had another one. I sold Christmas trees when I was like 14 or something like that. I convinced my dad to drive me up to a Christmas tree farm. 4 or 5 weeks out from Christmas, or maybe 4 weeks out from Christmas, and I bought it's like 20 Christmas trees at wholesale. Wow. And I convinced a petrol station that was on a major corner, like a major intersection, to let me stand on the front grass bit and with a Christmas tree business and like signs, you know, Christmas trees for 20 bucks or whatever it was. And back then, no one was really doing it, and a lot of them have them now. But it went really well. I sold out in like half a day. And I was like, oh, I'm doubling down on this. And so I called the Christmas tree farm and I said, how many Christmas trees do you have left? And they're like, 40. I said, if you drive them down to me, I'll take them all right now and I'll pay cash. And the guy said, okay, done. And I was like, great, amazing. This is incredible. I'm going to make so much money. And he drives down and delivers 40 of the ugliest, most poor excuses of Christmas trees ever because they're the last 40 like on the lot. So you can imagine what they look like. There was a couple there that had like two branches and like a little bit of green, like nothing at all. And I was trying to sell these things for the next 3 days. And I ended up with about 15 left over, and that was my entire profit. So my profit was 15 Christmas trees on that business.
But a valuable lesson, though.
Yeah, yeah, valuable lesson in, like, seeing the stock before you buy it. Yeah, that's for sure.
Absolutely. But it and that's a good lesson to learn at 14 rather than 20 years later.
Yeah,
as well,
so. Yeah, exactly. So that it was a good lesson. I was really happy to see read like later that Richard Branson had actually done a Christmas tree business too, and I didn't realize at the time. So we'd both done it independently, and I was, it was about where the similarities end. But it was kind of nice to have that
It sounds like your parents have been quite supportive in that those years. There wasn't that sort of case where your father, when you were 14, was just sort of rolling his eyes at going, here we go, Christmas trees. Is that the...
No, he was worse than me. He was encouraging me.
Oh, dear.
He was like, he was an entrepreneur, had some luck, you know, had some good stuff, had some not so good stuff, as most of us have. And but he was really encouraging. I probably think that's where I got the excitement around starting businesses. And then I probably got the more kind of more sensible financial side from my mum. So, you know, combine those two skill sets and it's you're probably in a better place than just enthusiastic.
Yeah. So I just want to go back to the About Us page that we spoke about at the start. You mentioned that's easy for you guys to sort of put together. I just want to get an understanding of, because there's quite a few questions in that's come from that page, but I just want to get an understanding of how you take those the pledges and the, you know, that tribe cultural thing. How do you make that come alive in the business, and what are the things that you do that you think other businesses should do, irrespective of whether they've got 100 plus staff or whether they've got 5 staff?
Yeah, I think the one of the more important things to get right in a business is like the obviously the culture of the business. And I think to have a great culture, which really determines the success or failure of a business. I mean, it's so important. You know, people make or break a business. So I think it's one of the things you just have to get right. And so I think to get that right, you need to know who you are and what you do and why you do it. I think you need to have a really strong proposition and understand that. And I think to get that right and to have people understand what you do is so important. And in order to do that, you need to communicate it clearly and strongly and regularly. And so I think, you know, for us to have a great culture that we do, we had to decide, you know, who we are, who we were and what we stood for and why we were doing what we were doing. And then we had to make that clear to our team and to everyone that became a member or was in touch with our business. And in order to do that, you need to state it clearly and everywhere and regularly. And I think so we've got it up on our walls. It's part of our decision process. It's part of our meetings. We refer to it. We refer to it when we are making decisions or there is a challenge, and we put it into the town halls. It's you've got to live and breathe it, because if you don't, it becomes something that you write and then you put it in a book and you put it away and you never refer to it again. So I think probably the most important thing to get right is culture in a business. But then once you've got it right, to keep it, you have to live and breathe it. And so I think that's what's so important.
What are some of the things that you would do that would actually, I mean, you've mentioned putting these on the walls, and I think that's a fantastic idea. And I've, you know, suggested that to many businesses in the past, that mission statements and promises and have those visible to everybody. But are there some other things that you do with the team that you go to sort of bring them together as a team to sort of demonstrate that culture or live that culture?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it, you know, there's so many things that we do. So, you know, one of our credos is to do some good. And so the do some good is basically do some good for the world. And in order to do that, there's numerous initiatives that we have, but, you know, one of them is called, you know, Wine for Good. And that's where we use wine and what we do for the good of the world. And one of those kind of things that we do, one of the projects that we do is it's called the Vino Bomb. And so the Vino Bomb is basically we get our community to nominate privately through social, so not tag the person they're nominating, so the person doesn't know. And it's kind of like a random acts of kindness thing. So they nominate someone who deserves recognition but doesn't normally get recognition. So we want to recognize those people doing some great things in the world, but don't normally get the recognition. You know, the people that are, you know, whether they're looking after, you know, animals that need care, or whether there's domestic violence. It's all the people behind the scenes that don't actually get the recognition for doing this amazing work. So we get people to nominate, get our community of, you know, 500,000 people to nominate people they think are worthy. And we get like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and sometimes thousands of nominations. And then we go through them all and we investigate the story and we have a shortlist. And then we get one of our team leads to choose like a top couple, and then we go through those even more, and we finally choose one person to do a vino bomb for. And a vino bomb is basically this beautiful wooden hand kind of carved box with vino mofo on it, and it's full of goodies. So it's like full of wine, and it's full of goodies from other partners, like whether it's massages, gift vouchers, you know, beautiful spa products. And we random, it's like a random kind of, so we surprise them in where they live or where they work, and we rock up with the team, you know, with a bunch of people from our team in our combi, and do this this kind of surprise delivery to this person. And that's like, and so what that does is, it's one, it goes along with our credo of doing some good and recognizing amazing people doing some good for the world, but it allows our team to be part of that process and to be part of delivering this amazing experience to these people that are so deserving. And it's such a beautiful thing. Yeah. Like the first couple of times we did it, you know, because we've been doing it for like many years now, we've delivered hundreds and hundreds now. The first couple of times we didn't take any photography or video because we really want it to be for our team and for the people, and not about this, like, let's promote how wonderful we are. So for the first kind of like, I don't know, couple of months of doing it, we didn't actually get any footage, which is a shame. But we would get these calls, and like through customer service, from these people that had this vino bomb delivered to them, and like they'd be asking to chat to Andre or myself. And so I remember this one time when in particular the customer service kind of put their hand up to me and said, hey, Justin, can you come over and chat to this lady? She's just received a vino bomb and she's beside herself and she really wants to talk to you. And I was like, okay. So I chatted and she was bawling her eyes out. And I almost cried myself. I probably did actually. And it was, and she was just, she was at breaking point in her life, and she was doing so much good for the world. And she, it just meant so much to her because she was doing it by herself for, you know, she was doing it for all the right reasons, but she was doing it, as a single person trying to change the world, and it was just feeling quite overwhelmed. And then she gets this random act of kindness that a friend had nominated her for. And we delivered, and she just really needed it. And so she just let out all this emotion. It was the most beautiful thing. And I thought, oh my God, we've got to capture this.
Yeah.
We've just got to capture this. And then so about a month or so in, we started capturing it. And this footage is just the most beautiful footage in the world. And they're just so, they're such good people and so deserving. And very, very rarely are they recognized for the work that they do. And to see them be appreciated and be rewarded and feel like people know what they're doing and are thanking them for it, it was just amazing. And anyway, that's just one of the things that flows from that credo, you know, do some good for the world. And then you get your team involved, you help the community, you get your community involved, the team's involved, you're delivering this great thing to a really deserving person who's doing amazing things for the world. And, you know, so you're living and breathing this credo, and that's, I guess, really important. And that's how we kind of bring parts of our credo into our business.
I think that that's important irrespective of the size of the business. But I think a lot of businesses are scared of that. I think two things. They're scared of perhaps taking time out to do that, the smaller businesses. And the second thing is, I think sometimes they feel exactly as you've said there, that it's a bit of shameless self-publicity.
Yep.
When I don't think it is, I think you just need to sort of approach it with a different view rather than...
Well, it needs to be authentic. It needs to be real. Yeah. Like if you're doing it for the wrong reasons, it's quickly going to be discovered. Yeah. People see through that straight away. You know what I mean? Like if you're doing things for the wrong reasons, people can tell. People aren't silly.
Yeah. Well, I had the interview last week was a guy called Nick Bowditch who used to work for Facebook.
Nick,
you know,
yeah.
Lots of people know Nick.
He's popular.
And one of his cornerstones is authenticity. You know, and he often says it's you know, very easy to see through people who aren't authentic, and you know, authentic stories on social media really you know, they're the sort of things that people want to engage with and and that kind of thing. So just on that note of, you know, people facing those challenges, looking again at your About Us page, there's several references there along that story to you guys being broke and not having much money. I mean, again, the lesson I want to kind of get from that is how did you keep going? What was in the back of your head or the front of your head even that said, this is a great idea, and you didn't think about, you know, jacking it in and going and getting a normal job? Because again, there's small businesses, medium-sized businesses out there who are probably in that situation every day. I'm just interested to kind of get your psychological take on how you push through that.
Stupidity? I think it was a little bit of stupidity, a little bit of ignorance. I think, honestly, the first 4 or so years of working with Andre were really, really tough because we started with Quaff and it had a pretty average business model. It was getting some really good traction in the market, but the actual business model wasn't very good. And then we pivoted that 3 or 4 times to eventually end up with Vino Mofo. So how did we get through it? You know what? We actually did look for jobs at one point because we were so broke. And Andre, being my brother-in-law, when, you know, the business wasn't doing very well and I wasn't doing very well, it also meant my sister wasn't doing very well.
Yeah.
So I had that extra pressure. And, you know, we're really, really close family. And I think seeing my sister go through the stuff was far more powerful than me having to go through it. And so there was a couple of years there where, you know, she would go to the supermarket and get groceries, walk up to the cash register, and her card wouldn't work. So she'd actually have to. Sometimes she'd just leave the groceries there, and walk out and go, oh, I've got to go and transfer some money. Super embarrassed and not be able to afford groceries. And so, and you know, we're a really close family, and I adore my sister. And to see my sister go through that was really, really hard. So look, you know, the first year was really tough. The second year was better, but still tough. Third year was better again, but still kind of tough. But in that second to third year, I remember Jody saying, Jody's my sister, Jody saying to Andre, you know, I can't keep doing this. Yeah. You know, we've got 2 young kids. They had 2 kids at this stage, you know, and they were barely, you know, they were, you know, getting chased by creditors. They were hardly being able to afford their rent because, you know, when I say it was tough years, they were tough years. And so my poor sister, after, you know, having some pretty average Christmases, was like, I can't keep doing this. I just cannot keep doing this, Andre. And so, you know, Andre was always so super positive and going, no, we're just around the corner. We're just around, this thing's going to happen. That's going to change everything. You know, as entrepreneurs do, we just keep going, yes, just around the corner. It's just around the corner. It's going to all break and it's going to be amazing. But then my sister would start asking me because she didn't believe Andre anymore. So then I can't lie to my sister. So she would go, Justin, like, I don't believe Andre anymore. Like, is it going to be okay? Is this happening in this time? And I was like, just give us like this amount of time. Like, just give us like 6 months or 3 months. And she'd be like, okay, I can give you like this amount of time, or seriously, Justin, please stop it for our family's sake. And I'm like, oh my God, my sister who I adore is, who we've made poor for years, is basically asking me for, you know, if I love her, please, please give up. So that's really kind of tough to work through.
That's some pressure. Yeah, I ran my own agency and I had exactly the same experience as your sister, and I stood in a supermarket and I swiped the card to pay for, I think, $25 worth of groceries, and the card got rejected and I had no other accounts to transfer money into. But the difference with me, it was just me, you know, and it was, I didn't have the responsibilities of, you know, it wasn't impacting on other members of my family, or there wasn't children at that time. So I can imagine the stress of doing that. And I guess now, I mean, you guys must owe her a fairly hefty debt of gratitude for sticking with you.
I think she's okay now. She's doing all right now. But she was, but you know, that we did actually go looking for jobs at one point. So we thought we, Andre came to me and he'd had the big chat, and she's like, he's, you know, she said, we've agreed to a time frame and this is what it is. And then we hit that time frame and we still were in trouble. And he begged for another couple of months, and we got through. But it was at a point there, you know, about two or three promises in, that we went looking for jobs, and we got offered jobs. I got offered a great job at a winery that I loved, and Andre got offered a great job at a tourism body, doing kind of like wine kind of related videos, like as a wine tourism body, and we came back together. And I think that's when we felt like the biggest failures. That's when we felt that this, you know, I think giving up and going looking for work and then accepting it and feeling like, okay, we've failed, we need to move on now and we need to take these other roles for the sake of our family. That was the moment when we came together and we'd both been offered jobs that we sat there looking at each other and probably the most disappointed. But it was also the same conversation where we went, we're not taking those jobs, are we? And we went and had another conversation with Jody.
Wow, your poor sister, when she found out you were both turning down good jobs.
Yeah. And the poor thing, she probably cried a little bit, which is understandable, but thank God we did.
Yeah.
Because that was the turning point for us. And then we started working and getting better from there. And so she stuck with us, but you know, now she's good. She's really happy. She's thankful that we stuck to it. And, you know, that kind of led to a couple of really great businesses.
I just want to ask a couple of questions from a marketing perspective. That growth of Vinomofo in those early years, what did you find worked best for you guys? What were the channels to the end user that you just went, wow, this is working. Let's just, you know, double down on this. You know, this channel.
Yeah, so what has always been the biggest for us has been referral. Right. So very, very early, it was deliver the most amazing experience so your customers want to tell their friends about you. And it's simple stuff and it's age old, but referral has always been and still is today our biggest channel of new members and new customers. So that was always super powerful. You know, we incentivized it to encourage people. It was like, you know, $25, $25. So 25 for the person referring, 25 for the new member on their first purchase. And that, you know, we played around with different incentives, you know, $50 one way, $20, $10. And we found that 25 each way for us is the best way and encourages the most. And, you know, we still rely on that hugely today. It's such a great channel. And the funny thing is the lifetime value of customers coming through referral is so good. It is so much higher than most other channels because the connection is real.
Yeah.
You know, they've been referred by someone they trust. So that's always been really powerful.
What sort of, and you don't have to answer this because this might be sensitive information, but I'm just trying to understand from your perspective, how many people would be referring? I mean,
as in like a percentage of
audience? Every 10 signups you get, how many of those have been referred or how many of those are then referring people? Or
about 50% of the people refer.
Wow.
50% of the people refer, but of the people that are actually joining, because not everyone obviously joins.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's referrals probably in that 20 to 30% mark, I reckon, regularly.
Yeah.
And that's huge numbers now.
That's big numbers.
Because people are not just referring one person either. You know, they're referring 10. So sometimes the referral has been well over 50% of new customers, which is amazing. And that's free, really. You're giving away a credit, but it's on a purchase, which is, you know, there's a profit in a purchase anyway. So it's literally free. So it's a great channel. And they're worth so much, as, you know, their lifetime values are so strong because of that connection, I think.
I've just come back from Japan. I had a conversation with the company I was working for there about launching into that company. And I'm going to talk to you about, because you're launching into Japan soon, aren't you?
Japan's on the cards, but it's not the next market.
Okay.
You go.
The reason I asked that is because I was in Japan looking at your site and the little thing pops up and says.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, my conversation with them was about trial, was about saying instead of spending thousands of dollars or millions of yen, as it were, on, you know, magazine advertising and print advertising and those kind of things, we should just be giving the product to people to experience it so that they can then make a decision based on actually having something tangible in their hands to trial.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree with you. I think giving people the opportunity to try a service or reinvesting in your own audience is the most powerful thing you can do.
Are there any other channels? Obviously, that you know, the cornerstone of your business is going to be that referral traffic. But is there anything else that you find works really well for you guys?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. Two main ones, like social's huge.
Yeah.
Facebook and Facebook advertising is massive. That's one of our major channels.
Okay.
Always has been. You know, different businesses suit different channels. You know, some businesses really suit visual, where you look at Instagram, and we still use Instagram and we're using it more and more, but it's a very visual channel. Facebook's great for other businesses more so, and it's always been amazing for us. What we've found with social though is as new platforms come out, you get in early, super early before everyone else is in them, and you don't have the big corporates using huge budgets to buy up that space, and you get much cheaper advertising early. So we were super early into Twitter and Facebook, and really kind of turned that up, dialed that up as much as we could really early, because it was such an efficient channel.
Yeah.
And it's got less so as more and more money has flooded in. You know, once you've got, you know, the massive corporations around the world competing for Facebook advertising, the budget, you know, the cost per click and the cost per acquisition is going to go up, as it has and it continues to do. So we always look for new platforms. You know, we played around with Snapchat early. It's a younger audience, so, you know, didn't particularly love it for us. But, you know, Instagram's great. Twitter in the early days was phenomenal. It was one of those things that we were the first wine company to advertise on Twitter in Australia. And when we were doing that many years ago, we were getting customers like so cheaply. Yeah. It was insane. I couldn't spend enough money through the platform. Now it's not even worth it for us. No. Through Twitter, you just wouldn't do it. It's way too expensive. And Facebook's still great up to a point. But yeah, so I guess, you know, long story short is social has been amazing for us, both paid and organic, especially when you go in super early.
Are they the good channels for you if you're going into a new country? Because obviously that referral traffic probably doesn't exist straight away.
No, it doesn't. So what we do when we go into a new country, it's basically grassroots mentality, startup lean mentality, where we create the business like we did in Australia. We build a community from one person to 100 to 1,000, and we rely on those people to refer their friends. So what we do when we land in a country is we get people from Australia or the other countries that we've launched to refer their friends in those countries first. And then second, we do a PR campaign where I go and talk to all the media as much as I can. We focus on like the food and wine scene and the startup scene. So I go and spend lots of time in the startup communities because they're the early adopters that get the message out there as quickly as possible. So, you know, startup communities, food and wine scene, and just the bigger media that are talking in the spaces that we want to be heard. So that's the kind of plan. And then lots of events and lots of one-on-one. And we really do build it from the ground up. It's like I'm literally sitting there with one person on day one and telling them the story. And then I'm sitting there with 10 people, and then we have an event and it's 50 people. And then the next time it's 150 people. And they're the early adopters. You know, they're the kind of the advocates that know me personally and tell all their friends about it. And that's how we've done it in Australia. It's how we've done it in New Zealand and Singapore. And it's how we'll do it in every market going forward. So it's really as if we were a startup every time we go into a new country. We don't go in with big budgets.
I saw obviously public speaking for you is now is obviously now an important part of what you do. And I'm guessing it's one of those things I've said to a lot of businesses: if you do have the capacity to stand up and talk in front of people, be it at a local, like a BNI event, or be it at a, you know, Chamber of Commerce or something like that, that is to grow your business. That's a, you know, that's always a fantastic opportunity because it's free. People get to experience that you're an expert in your industry. You swap business cards, you get talking, you meet people. It's interesting that you go back to square one almost.
Yeah.
In every country.
Exactly. And it's fantastic. You know, you get to you get to meet people. It's about those relationships, as all businesses are about relationships. You know that, and everyone does. And it's if you can build those relationships and get them to tell your story, it's super powerful. And you know, getting to getting to the speaking engagements which you're talking about, I think that's so powerful. And I know a lot of people don't do it because it's so scary. You know, the people fear standing in front of people and delivering a message, and I completely understand it. I used to be the same, and you know,
it's absolutely terrifying for some people. Oh, yeah, I completely get it. But once you get over it,
you've got like nerves, you're shaking, but you just do it. Like if you just don't give yourself a choice and just get up and deliver the message, the first time's awful, the second time's pretty bad, the third time's okay, and then all of a sudden it becomes quite normal and easy, and eventually you become really good at it, and it's such a powerful medium to tell your story, because one, like you said, you become an expert in your field. Two, you have an opportunity to have, whether it's 50 people or 1,000 people that are listening to you, you have their attention for an hour or half an hour to talk about who you are and what you do and your business and what you want to achieve. And that's, it's really hard to get that much attention from that many people for that long, you know?
I think the other slight advantage that, you know, potentially you would have, and when I talk to people as well, is that we've probably got subject matter that people are quite interested in. If you're an accountant or you're a financial planner or those kind of things, I sometimes think they might struggle more because, you know, who wants to really listen to an accountant talking to you for an hour?
Just offended all the accountants listening.
No, absolutely not. I think there's a lot of accountants that would agree with that as well.
they're the first to do that.
But I think one of the things they've got to look at is it's about being creative in that conversation. It's, you know, that people don't want you to get up and talk about best accounting practices and things like that. But you know, people might want to get up and you to talk about, you know, 10 quirky ways which you can save tax or things like that. It's it's the approach that you take versus what you actually do for a living. I think people have just, a lot of people need to sort of just look at it from another angle sometimes.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we encourage that for all of our team too. Like just thinking about accountants talking, our CFO, we have been encouraged to, you know, go out and on the speaker circuit where she can. And now she, you know, she's flying to the States in January, I think, to deliver a talk at a conference. Which is amazing. So she did her first one a couple of months ago. She's done another one since, and she, you know, super nervous and stuff, but she's amazing. And she was involved in a panel recently, and then like our head of marketing, Kip, who is amazing, but probably the most fearful person I've ever met of standing in front of the crowd. And I actually forced him to do the first one and he hated me for it. But he, once he'd got through it and, you know, his face went bright red and he's sweating. And, but once he'd got through it, he thanked me and he's like, that was actually amazing. And then the second time he did it, he was a little bit less nervous and he delivered a great speech. But you know, if you've got your team, you know, you've got marketing, our head of culture does talks now, Andre and I do talks, our CFO does talks. You think about all the people you're reaching in all the different ways you're reaching them. It's really, really powerful.
Yeah. This is just going slightly off subject. I've got a friend of mine who's challenged me to do stand-up comedy.
Oh, wow.
And there's a little comedy club around there. And I am genuinely terrified.
I would be too.
You've only got to get up and do 5 minutes.
Still.
But I vowed to do it because it's something he wants to do. And I said to him, I'd support him, and I'd support him by doing it myself. Because I said to him, if you do it, I'll do it. And he's been wanting to do it for like 8 years. So we're just gradually getting closer and closer. But for me, I feel comfortable getting up and talking in front of people. And I wanted to go, right, what could I do next that would scare the crap out of me?
Yeah.
And that would be good. I'm looking forward to it in a strange kind of perverse way, but maybe there's a challenge there for a few of your team to perhaps.
Oh God, don't throw out that challenge. Don't throw out that challenge. Because
it's on the podcast
year.
Now, your,
yeah,
your stuff.
I know. Hope no one listens to it that I work with. They'll be like, Justin, next challenge, stand up comedy. I'll be like, oh God. I'm a little bit funny. I'm not that funny.
So just on those final, the marketing channels, there's a couple of other marketing questions I just wanted to ask you. The first one was, what doesn't work? What if you guys tried and just gone, nah, we're not doing that, or it's too expensive, or it didn't get the return on investment, those kind of things?
I think one of the things is knowing where to turn off the spend in most of the channels. So, you know, if you go, all right, this month we've, you know, this year you're spending 100 grand a month on marketing, and then all of a sudden you're spending 300 grand a month, there becomes a point where all channels are no longer useful, or, you know, no longer worthwhile or feasible to spend because the acquisition costs go up. So I reckon all channels get to that point, or obviously you just keep spending. As far as ones that haven't worked, for us, the ones that have really probably been a waste of time have been the smaller partnerships where you spend a lot of time for very little reward. You know, so lots of small partnerships with small kind of smaller businesses that didn't have much reach has been, you know, like there's been businesses that we've wanted to work with because we like the founders or we like the brand. But then, you know, the time and energy for a team that, you know, you keep lean, so very limited time, so they're all working lots of hours. If they're investing a big chunk of time into a smaller partnership, it often hasn't worked.
Yeah.
You know, sponsorships are a hard one to justify in a marketing, sense. They never really work, but...
I struggle with sponsorships unless it's a... You know, unless it's a localized business and it's like a small sports club, and, you can get access to a database of the mums and dads for, you know, a couple of $100 a year. Maybe it's but yeah, I struggle with sponsorships. I really do.
And we're a wine business, so you know we get asked, you know, 10 times a week to sponsor something for the drinks. And if you're if you're sponsoring the wines, you know, it doesn't matter if your logo's up on the screen and they mention you three times and people don't care. They're there to eat food, drink wine and, you know, socialize. So very rarely has that ever been any use to us. So the way we do it now is we just choose those ones that we want to do for our do good part of our credo, you know. Gotcha. So it's all charitable. It's all kind of causes that we believe in, you know, that we choose four or five causes every quarter that we focus on, and if we'll support them. And we've also found, you know, just focusing on four or five is far stronger, and it's an easier way to get the biggest impact if all your energy, time and money and resources are focused on, you know, four or five.
I used to field the sponsorship inquiries for Forex when I worked there years ago.
Yeah.
And I can probably imagine the sort of things that you get through email every day. But we used to get people asking for sponsorships of under 11 sports teams as they wanted a Forex logo on their kids' shirt.
Oh, perfect. And we were like, perfect brand alignment.
I was going to say, do you not see the problem with this? But they didn't. It was, you know, Forex is one of those brands that's so ingrained in that local Queensland community up here that they never even consider that would have been a problem. So I'd imagine you get a few inappropriate ones every now and again.
Yeah, we do, and sometimes we wonder like if the person had thought at all before they asked us. You know, it's like there's just some things that just do not go with wine. You know, there's just some things that do not go with wine, and so we don't do that.
The last marketing techie question I've got for you is, you've got a lot of data. You've got a lot of people on your lists across multiple countries and populations and postcodes and demographics. What system do you guys use to manage all that? Is it something you've built yourself, or is it something that's off the shelf? What's, you know, just out of interest, because there's obviously, you know, a lot of systems out there that people might be looking at for things like that.
Yeah, so we've done both. So we originally used an off the shelf. I can't remember what it was called. For the life of me, I can't remember. And then we custom built, because the off the shelf wasn't working for us, and we had all this great data, and it just wasn't seeming to deliver what it needed to deliver. And then we thought, this is good. We can custom build this thing. And we spent probably 9 months with one developer fully focused on custom building this system, and didn't work. like right. 1,000 different, you know, like yeah. You know, that it was a decision tree thing, and yes. you know, like yes. all these different things, and he put in so much time. It was going to be based on like all the behavior and pages they were viewing, and all the stuff that, you know, the personalization tools use these days. And it just didn't work. It just did not move the dial. Yeah. And we were like, oh God. So then, you know, we would call around our other founders that, you know, are great mates and run these huge successful companies, asking them what they were doing. And they're like, oh, so anyway, we've just custom built our thing and it's not working. or someone would say, oh, we custom built it first. Now we're onto this like other tool and oh, it's not working. Like it's just this never ending kind of wow. Thing of like trying to get that right. But having said all that, we are using a tool now actually. And the thing that makes any tool work better is just getting the basic data right. What we found, because we were like, it was just so complicated and there's so many things leading into this personalization tool, you know, like the page they clicked on or how long they spent on this or, you know, the products that they, you know, looked at or referred or talked about, like just so many different things or opened in the email. And once you look at all of these data points and trying to bring that together to personalize, we were going, it was so complicated, it just wasn't moving the dial. So then we were like, well, what about if we just ask them?
Yeah.
Like, what if we just do a survey and ask them the question? And so we were just like, do you like white or red? Oh, red's my favorite. Okay, do you like Shiraz, which was your favorite, Shiraz or Cabernet or Pinot Noir? And they were answering these things and we're using that data to personalize their experience, and it works like massively. Like it's wow. that moved the dial. So we realized that get the simple things right before you go super complicated. And it is like, we are talking huge shifts in our results by just focusing on the simple things.
Wow. That's, I mean, that's huge. I think a lot of people, a lot of businesses don't, I've had the same experience where I worked for a business that was getting something like 8,000 new signups a day. It was a small piece of software, but we were trying to, I think we were just generally trying to overcomplicate things because it was so many different target markets were coming in, corporate, education, and, you know, just general users. And it was almost like, you know, a deer in the headlights with all this data coming towards everybody and going, what do we do? Somebody make a decision, you know, and then you kind of get that, you get paralyzed.
Exactly. And too much information just is confusing. And I know that once you layer upon the simple stuff, there is tremendous value and some companies do it really well. I just don't know many of them. Like I just don't know many of them. I think when you get the simple things right, it really moves the dial, and the added layers can help, but it doesn't, it's not a really common theme for me to hear from my founder friends when they've tried these things. Oh my God, we got all the data in the world and my God, it moved the dial compared to we got the simple stuff and it changed our business. You know,
I unsubscribed from Myer's email campaigns probably a good 2-3 years ago because I was just getting email blasts for things that were completely inappropriate for me. You know, and I went, somebody somewhere in Myer must have said, why don't we just ask this guy what he wants? You know, but nobody had ever done that. They just went, you know what, we've got 100,000 people. Let's just all send them the same thing. You know, and I can't believe that clearly wasn't working for them because, you know, the position they're in now. But so I get the same thing from Fish Pond are that kind of sort of small Australian version of Amazon, you know. And I'll go and look at a couple of books on Fish Pond and then I'll get books recommended in email that are completely inappropriate that I'm just not interested in.
And it's such a negative experience.
Oh,
it's,
absolutely.
You know, it just kills a brand when you're, especially if you ask for information and you don't deliver on it. You're like, okay, I invested in this. I invested in this and you're not making any use of it.
Yeah, I have a habit of buying too many books that I can actually read, and I know that if Fishpond got their act together, they'd be getting a purchase off me, you know, weekly or fortnightly. But
and conversion rates on emails when they're super targeted to the right audience are so powerful, and unsubscribes are so much lower.
Is a good channel for you, email?
Oh, huge! It's huge for us. You know, it's still probably 60% maybe. of our sales are come directly from email, and you know that used to be 90%, but as you get a larger audience and a bigger brand, yeah, then you get the organic and you get people just you know, thinking wine, thinking vino mofo, so they come directly on thought as opposed to being pushed. But you know, email's huge and powerful for us, and you can see the impact of personalization with the results, open rates, click through, and unsubscribe levels. It's phenomenal. You're talking like 3-4 times the conversion. It's incredible.
Right. We're on this final straight now, so I've got 3 more questions for you. Cool. The first one I ask everybody, I want to understand some of the brands that you like outside of your category, outside of your channel. Things that you might go back and buy frequently, brands that you aspire to emulate. Last week I actually had toilet paper, so feel free. Nick Bowditch. Yes, that was Nick. Yeah, Bowditch.
Did he say who gives a crap? Was that his toilet paper brand or?
No, Kleenex.
Oh, okay. So
he's excited about Kleenex toilet paper.
Oh, that sounds like Nick.
he may have been winding me up. But
yeah, I think he may have been. But
he said it with such passion. I kind of went, well, perhaps he is that interested. I don't know.
You never know. Anyway, he's a passionate guy too. But I reckon he's a funny guy. I really like him. But it reminds me of the toilet brand, the toilet paper. Do you know who gives a crap?
No, I've never heard of that. No.
Oh, it's a social good kind of enterprise. So I think it's like 50% of the profits go back into supplying like sanitary product or something like that to third world countries.
Now you've said that rings a bell. Yes.
Yeah, and I think it's a really good business. And one of our graphic designers, he used to work for Vino Mofo, now works for them. And I wasn't going to even think about that brand, but that is a cool brand. I actually really like that brand. Like, the branding's cool. What they do for the world's good. And you know, they're cheeky, it's colorful. I think they've got a good brand, which I wouldn't have thought of until you said the toilet paper story with Nick. But, the other ones, I've always loved Virgin, you know, Richard Branson, Virgin. I love his attitude to life. I love his attitude to business around, you know, let's give a lot of stuff a go and see what sticks. I love that. I love the attitude within the brand. So that's probably one of those brands, but you know, so many entrepreneurs would say that brand, I think. There's some great startup brands in Australia that have done really well recently that I love. I love Canva.
Canva's a good brand. Yeah.
Yeah, I really like it because the brand represents, which I think is so important with brands, is to have authenticity around the founders. And Mel and Cliff, who are good mates of mine who started Canva, are just beautiful, fun, friendly, slightly cheeky people. And that's exactly what the brand is, you know? It kind of represents who they are. And I think that's what Andre and I have with Vino Mofo. Vino Mofo is very much us.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's really powerful. And, you know, Virgin's very much Richard Branson.
Yeah.
And so I think there's similarities in the brands that I love, and I think it's an authenticity around who they are and why they're doing what they're doing. And so I think they're the brands that kind of talk to me.
Okay. That's good. Well, another toilet paper associate, another toilet associated brand.
There's a theme coming.
Maybe there is, because we, in the other segment on this show, we always tend to talk about poo as well. So it's, I don't know how we keep getting onto these things. Anyway, what's next for the brand? What's next for you guys? What country's next? Is there something else that you've got in the pipeline in terms of expansion, or, you know?
Yes. So, I mean, it's a super exciting phase for us. So we launched, obviously, Australia first. About a year and a bit ago, we launched into New Zealand, which is our first overseas market. Then just under a year ago, we launched into Singapore. And that market is just killing it. It's amazing. It's growing so fast. It's incredible. But the next one is the US. So we're launching.
The big one.
The big one. We're launching in the States in probably April, May. Is the plan. You know, I'm aiming for April. My team thinks I'm crazy, so it'll probably be May. but I'm going over there probably in December and January. I'm in full preparation mode for the States. You know, we've got the legals being sorted. I'm chatting to all the people you need to chat to. So that's really, really exciting for us because it's such a massive market. You know, we looked at going the, we were staying in Asia and going the other way and doing Hong Kong then through to China. But I spent a fair bit of time in each of those markets. And it's one of those things that I've kind of learned through, you know, plenty of mistakes early where if I, you know, I've got to go with my gut because if I don't go with my gut, that's where the problems or the challenges or the mistakes have been made. You know, like you go, you gather all the information you can, obviously, like size of market, what they're drinking, how much they're spending, you know, all the things that make sense as a business. But then you kind of got to feel it and go into that market and just get a gut feel for me. And so
What was it about China that didn't
– Look, I think
– Didn't endear you.
Well, there's a lot of challenges in China. There's yeah. so many. But I think probably – I think there was enough of a market there for sure. Like it's a huge market and there's enough of a market within our kind of target market. But I think it was a regulatory kind of stuff that was happening. You know, it's changing all the time. Like they've just recently made it so you have to own the logistics business if you're delivering liquid. So you need to own the courier business. And so in order for us to set up in China, you actually need to own a courier business. So you'd have to set that up as well. So just extra challenges. And that is something that happened only recently. And it just changes the landscape. And the landscape changes so frequently there. And it's so different from, you know, Beijing to Shanghai to Guangzhou. It's just so different. You've got to learn so much. You've got to know so many people. And the thing changes so fast and for sometimes no reason. I just got a feeling like, look, America is sitting there. It's still the biggest market in the world. There is 100 million people drinking wine. They're currently drinking about 9 liters a head per capita, but they're heading towards, you know, 20. And it's growing fast. And there's almost $1 billion worth of Australian wine sent over there every year. It's a really super exciting market. And California alone is much bigger than Australia. So there's just such a huge opportunity. It's English speaking. So you don't have that culturally quite aligned. They understand our brand. They understand us as Aussies. It just made so much more sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. I think I really appreciate you giving me your time today. And I cannot wait to see you guys in the US because I think one thing that the public likes is to see an Australian company go and kick some ass in the US.
Yeah.
So I think everyone will be watching that. And obviously there's some good Australian startups out there now, isn't there? The Atlassian guys.
Amazing. Actually, it's Mike's birthday today.
Okay.
I saw him yesterday. But, the Atlassian guys are killing it. Canva is absolutely killing it as well. There's so many great businesses. Safety Culture is killing it.
What's the 99 Designs?
Oh, yeah. 99 Designs have been a hero for a long time. They're one of the early ones. And they're still going great guns. So we've got such exciting startups and, you know, global startups now, which are just, you know, really killing it on a global stage, which is so exciting to see.
And I don't think we talk about them enough, you know, those kind of, that might just be my perception, but there's always this kind of talk about the Kiwi startups, the Zeros of this world and things like that. But, you know, I think the Australian ones are giving everybody a really good run for their money and it would be fantastic to see you out there doing exactly the same as that. So
thank you. We plan to, so thank you.
Yeah. If people want to contact you, if they're interested in having you speak somewhere or they just want to ask you a question, what's the best way? And for God's sake, don't put your mobile number. Or your email address.
I was going to say, I've made that mistake before. I would probably be best for me is either Twitter, Facebook or Instagram. So it's just Justin Dry on each of those and you'll find me. Connect up. Love to chat to the guys. I will definitely respond.
And I think what I'd like to do, assuming that I can keep myself in and focus and keep doing these podcasts, that I suddenly get distracted by something in a few months.
Become a stand-up comedian or something.
I think what we should do is we should catch up again in 6 months' time because I'd love to get just another snapshot of your experience launching it into the American market because I think perfect. That would be fast. So I need you to keep a little notebook of all the things that you think might be interesting.
You know what's interesting? You should Everyone should follow me on Instagram, because Instagram is the platform where I kind of do a behind the scenes of it takes, or my experience of a CEO, startup founder, expanding a company globally. And so you get all the behind the scenes stuff. You get me flying on planes, me having meetings, me in each of the countries, meeting with the right people in the communities and the networks. And so people will get an insight into that. So it's really fun. And I think people enjoy it if they're a kind of business owner interested in entrepreneurship, startup world, or even, you know, just watching a guy expand a business globally and how challenging and risky and amazing Absolutely. That is. So I think probably follow me on Instagram and Twitter. You'll see a lot of that stuff.
Thank you very much again for your time today. You never know that maybe the last hour is going to encourage me to go and get a bottle of wine this weekend and sit with my wife and drink it.
Please, please do.
or I might go buy a six pack or something.
You know what you could do too? If your audience is aren't members yet, and if you're not a member of VinoMofo yet, you should go to VinoMofo.com, but then do /Justin. So VinoMofo.com/Justin, and you'll get $25 off your first purchase. So
that's an offer that you just can't refuse.
Yeah, do that. And please, I'm going to watch to see if you join, pal. And I want you to order some wine.
You may well see my wife's name come through, because what? Okay. Once she realizes there's $25 off, she'll be on it like a shot.
What's her first name?
Renee.
Renee. All right, Renee. Let's do it.
So if you see it come through, then you know I've convinced her.
Okay.
Look, what we'll do is we'll put that link and everything in the show notes as well. So hopefully a few people sign up there. So, mate, thank you very much for your time. I really, really wish you the best of luck in the US, because it would be great to see you guys smash that. And I hope to everybody listening that they found some useful tidbits, they've useful information, useful ideas. And so once again, thank you to Justin for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it again for another episode of The Simon Dale Show. That was episode number 7. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any comments, questions, anything you'd like to contribute, please contact me, simon@simondell.com. You can find me on my website, simondell.com. You can find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all of the platforms. Just chuck in my name and you'll pretty much find me. Until next week, we'll see you all then. Thank you.